Accession number 32297, reel 18.
John Dixon, reel 18.
Okay, Richard, so we're now at Ballyhalbert, this lovely place in Northern Ireland. Frustrated, cold, miserable, and the only thing that sort of kept us going, I think, was the Squadron Spirit. We did a certain amount of flying. It was very sort of half-hearted. There were the usual little minor accidents, people taxiing into the mud and getting stuck, but nothing desperate, nothing really went wrong. It was just that, you know, it was pretty obvious that unless something happened fairly soon, Cedric Cox and our CEO and the bosses were going to find it difficult to keep morale up. We did, as I say, we did fly and we practiced and we did some addles and we were, in other words, trying to keep ourselves on top line. All this time we were, presumably, I didn't know, I mean, the junior officers didn't know what was going on, but presumably the ship was getting ready, but was being held up for various delays. Could have been some internal problems on the ship with the mechanics or the engineering, whatever, but we would have liked to have got on with it, but the ship wasn't ready for us. And at various times we moved about again. We seemed to spend half our time at Ballyhalbert, and then a few of us, or the squadron, got a bit fragmented. Some went across to Ayr on the west coast of Scotland, which was not too far across the Irish Sea, but not a very pleasant journey, because A, the weather was pretty dreadful, and of course you're very conscious of the fact there's a lot of high ground floating about around the Mull of Kintyre and that area. And there was one experience when could have ended in disaster. I think there were five of us, when I say five, I mean five aircraft, at Ballyhalbert, and they needed us at Ayr. So it seemed fairly straightforward that you just took off as five of us, and whoever was senior, I don't know who it was, certainly wasn't the boss, just led, and we were going to follow him into Ayr. But the weather closed right down. It was absolutely atrocious. We had great difficulty in keeping formation. I personally didn't have 100% confidence in the chap that was leading us, and one or two of the others had sort of lost formation and had split away. And I thought, well, I don't much like what's going on here, and I was very well aware that there was a lot of high ground about, and I often think of this trip when I hear about that dreadful Chinook that crashed up there some years ago, and they're still trying to work out what went wrong. But I was very conscious of the fact that I wasn't terribly happy about ploughing on through this awful weather. And we were down fairly low, trying to find out where we were. So I seized the initiative and turned back and went back to Ballyhalbert. When I got back there, three others had done exactly the same thing. I think one had got through, whether it was the leader or not, he did actually get through. There was no communication between us. I mean, nobody seemed to be making up their mind who was going to do what. It was just a question of follow my leader. And I wasn't too happy about that. Anyway, I wasn't the only one who turned back. So I think we stayed at Ballyhalbert for another couple of days before the weather cleared. And we were able to get back to Ayr eventually. But when we got there, again, we seemed to spend most time in bed. We didn't do anything. It was a very, half the squadron were here, half were there. Some had gone off on courses. It would have been nicer if they'd sent us all home on leave, but they didn't do that sort of thing.
And then obviously in poor weather, is it? It is the high ground that's the most worrying factor, is it?
Well, yeah, in my case, certainly, yeah. I mean, before you take off, you're conscious of where the high ground and how high the ground is. You've got your maps and you check these things. You don't always check the map absolutely because you know instinctively how high you should be flying. And okay, had we gone directly from Ballyhalbert to Ayr, we probably would have hadn't had to go too near the Mull of Kintyre. But when you're flying in that sort of weather, and you're not sure of the you know, of what the effect the wind is having on you, and how accurately the courses are being steered, and I thought it was wiser to turn back. But there we are.
And Ayr was much of the same thing, was it? Just
yes, we didn't have any particular role there. It was just somewhere to sleep. It was a strange sort of airfield. It didn't have any great role. It wasn't a particularly training airfield. It was just a sort of a holding place. And as I say, one or two of the observers had gone off on radar courses, and things were getting a bit frustrating.
It kind of reached that very end of
we'd had enough.
When did you hear that you were going to go to the carrier?
We didn't know exactly until just before it happened. I believe we actually went to the ship on the 25th of January, I think it was. Anyway, right at the end of January. And a few days before then, we must have all got together as a squadron again. And I believe we had all migrated back to Ballyhalbert. So we were all together as a unit, say from about the middle of January. And Cedric, our CO, obviously called us all together and said, right, the ship's ready, we'll be joining her on such and such a day, and you're all going to make your first deck landings, you see. So that got the adrenaline flowing a bit, as you can imagine. Now, I had never, ever seen an aircraft carrier from the air before. I'd seen one while we were floating about, as it were, but I'd never seen one from the air, and I wasn't the only one. And Cedric said, right, he said, we'll do a squadron formation and we'll fly out and we'll find the ship and we'll let her know who we are and we are here. We're not going to land on it today, but we'll just have a quick look, you see. So off we went in our best, tidiest formation, and we really put the shining bits on and made it absolutely spot on. And we flew over the ship in absolutely apple pie order. And very impressed they were, so we were told. And while trying to fly formation and keep your eye on who you were formating on, at the same time I was trying to look at the ship. And I didn't like what I saw because it didn't look terribly big. And she was floating about off the Isle of Arran. And I thought, oh dear, but nobody said anything. So we all went back and had a quick drink. I think that was it. But the next day, we went and did our first deck landings. At this point, I would say that the observers, except those flying with the very experienced people like Cedric and the senior pilot, the observers and the ground crew and the air gunners went to the ship by sea. They went out, they didn't fly out with us. So most of us rookies like me, obviously we had nobody in the back. And off we went in squadron formation again, and we went and just landed on the ship. And as a squadron, you see, this never happened normally. We just arrived as a squadron, 812, and we landed on the ship. And there must have been eight or nine of us who'd never ever deck landed before. And we landed perfectly well, no accidents, and there were huge celebrations. The ship's officers, of course, their moment had arrived that they'd all been trained for. They'd got their aircraft had suddenly arrived, and now they were an operational carrier, or were shortly to be one. And so there was a lovely party in the wardroom that night, and all the drinks were on the house. The ship's officers treated us all to drinks, which was wonderful, really. And of course, this was the moment, after all these months and years, when you suddenly said to yourself, "I am a naval aviator. I have landed on a ship at sea." So there we were. And the next day, I don't think I had too much to drink. Well, I'm sure I didn't, because the next day I had to fly off the ship with my full crew. So the first time I ever took off from a carrier, I had my full crew with me. So off I went with Jeff and Bambi in the back, and I did my second deck landing with my full crew. Some of the others who had not flown on the day before, they actually, I think there were three or four of them, actually did their first deck takeoff and their very first deck landing with their full crew. And I don't think there could be many people that could say they'd ever done that. So there we were, my second deck landing, I had the full crew on board. They didn't think there was anything to it.
Can you tell me about actually landing on, what the kind of arrangement of the barrier and the arrestor hooks are as well?
Well, the first thing, of course, you practice time and time again on that. You've got to get your spacing right. In other words, you must not trailing miles behind the plane in front of you, because the whole essence of flying from an aircraft carrier is it has to turn into wind. Which may be completely the wrong direction from where the captain really wants to be going. So he turns into wind, and it's up to the squadrons to land on and get landed in the shortest possible time. And we could do 12 aircraft onto the deck at no more than 20-second intervals between each one, and even less when we were fully worked up. But this was the object of the exercise. So when you were flying the circuit round, assuming you were following, you were number two or three or whatever in the pattern, if you realised that you were too close to the chap in front and were going to get waved off if you arrived too quickly, you didn't extend your downwind leg to make it longer. All you did was you moved out further out, so that you, when you turned crosswind, you had a slightly longer, so that you had to maintain this, trying to keep this 20-second interval between you and the chap in front. Now what happened was, once you landed on the deck, the deck crew rushed out from the side and they disengaged your arrestor hook, which you couldn't retract from the cockpit, not in those, in the Barracudas. So the deck crew came out. What you did, you'd landed on, you'd hooked the wire, you didn't put the brakes on, the plane slightly moved backwards, just a fraction, so that the deck crew could unhook the hook, and then they pushed the hook up manually into position, and then the deck control officer waved you forward like mad, and you opened the throttle and you just shot forward, and you went over these two barriers, which by then had been lowered. These barriers were like steel stanchions and wire stretched right across the deck, one in front of the other. The idea being, quite simply, that if you missed the wires, you crashed into the barriers to save you crashing into the aircraft that were already parked up on the forward part of the deck. So you taxied over the barriers as quickly as you could, and then the ground crew marshalled you into position. Your own squadron crews then rushed at the plane and folded the wings, and you stayed in the cockpit until all this was done, and they got you where you wanted, where they wanted you, on the deck. One or two may have gone immediately onto the forward lift, there's a lift, and they may have put the planes down into the hangar, but basically you just went out of the way forward, and that was that. And by the time you'd done all this, 20 seconds from the time that you'd gone over the barrier, the next chap was landing on. But they wouldn't let him land unless you were clear of the barriers, and the barriers were re-erected, which were done by the deck crew, obviously. But it was all a question of speed, speed, speed. It was, you daren't lag behind, and if you made a bad approach, and the deck control, the batsman, didn't like it, he had to wave you off. And you went round again, of course that was creating delays, and so you weren't a terribly popular pilot if you didn't, you know, keep your slot.
How did you drop the hook?
Well, there was just a control in the cockpit when you lowered the wheels. If you were going to land on the ship, there was just a lever, and I think it even actually had a little hook on the end of it to make it so that you knew which it was, and you just pushed it down and clonk, it fell down. I think there may have been a little light that came on to let you know that it was properly lowered, because you couldn't see it. But once it was lowered, you couldn't put it up. So in the dreadful event that you completely messed up your landing procedure, and if you'd lost your nerve or something, and if they eventually sent you away from the ship to land back on an aerodrome, you landed with the hook down because you couldn't retract it. And it never happened to any of us, thank goodness, but there were people in training who just lost their nerve and ended up back on the airfield training sparks behind them.
And how many arrestor wires did you have a chance of
catching? Our ship had eight. There were eight wires, as they went further forward, the last wire, number eight wire, which was just in front of the barrier, which was called the Jesus Christ wire. If you got that far up the deck, you were really in trouble. But they were all hydraulic. There were hydraulic tension on each wire, so that if you happened to catch the very first wire, the one nearest the stern, it had quite a long pull out, and it was, well, I'd say gentle, but it was a much slower deceleration than if you caught the last wire. Well, basically it was like flying into a wall, because, you know, that wire didn't have any give in it at all, or very little. I did have one experience when I had a problem, and I actually caught the seventh wire through no fault of my own, which didn't have much pull out, but it meant, because of the problem I had, I was going to run into the barrier. And the chap operating the barrier did his absolute best. He could see the minute I'd caught the wire, he dropped the barrier, but it didn't quite get lowered in time, so my propeller just hit the barrier and broke the propeller, but that was the only damage I ever did on a ship. But if you missed all the wires, well then you just crashed into the barrier.
Is there a wire that you tried to catch? Obviously, I mean, from the gentle deceleration, would you be trying to catch the first one off?
Well, you talk to or you read wonderful characters like Winkle Brown and the experts who could, select which one they were going to land on. Now, this never happened to us. I mean, basically, you, as I've said before, you were completely under the control of the batsman. And I think his remit really was to try and get you down between the second and the third wires. Probably that was where what he would like you to do. And that was the sort of comfortable feeling, because if you landed on those wires or caught those wires, you could feel the snag, and you knew that you weren't going to run into a barrier. So it was, that was quite comfortable. But obviously, so much depended on the movement of the ship. I mean, if the deck was coming up or going down, and this was controlled by the batsman. He gave you the cut to cut your throttle, depending on whether the deck was coming down or going up.
Where was he positioned as you were making your approach?
He was on the starboard side of the ship. Right aft, not right at the very end, he was probably about alongside the second wire, I would think, but right at the stern there was nobody sort of standing behind him, as it were, so there was no, you couldn't mistake him. I mean, he didn't merge into the scenery. He stood there, and by the side of him there was netting, so that if somebody made a dirty rush at the deck, more on his side than in the middle, and if he thought he was going to get clobbered by the wing or something, he could do a quick dive into the net. And if that ever happened, the pilot concerned always had to buy the poor bloke a drink. I don't remember it ever happening on our ship, but this was the and it did happen quite often. You know, if somebody's making a dirty rush at the deck.
Did he wear any kind of distinguishing clothing while he was on
the deck? Well, he had a yellow vest, or I don't know what you call them today, but he was very distinguishable. He had a yellow vest, and as I say, at night he had a yellow light in the middle of his chest and his bats. In daytime they were like a fluorescent yellow colour, so you couldn't miss him. But the extraordinary thing I find is that you look at photographs of batsmen in operation, and they're all wearing their caps. I could never keep my cap on the flight deck. But how he did, I don't know.
So with your landing on, you mentioned landing on. What about taking off? What's the procedure for taking off?
Well. Has anybody ever answered the question, how many different ways are there of taking off an aircraft carrier? I can only think of three. One is the ordinary way, where you're all the squadron are packed, or as many as they can get on, depending on the wind speed. You're packed right at the stern of the ship. And I've explained that we're all dovetailed together. You get your engines running, you've got everything ready to go, and you've signalled thunders up to the ground crew so they know that you're okay, and then the ship will turn into wind, and then when everything is ready, the commander flying, who's on the bridge, will make an affirmative signal, which always used to be done by a sort of a shutterboard thing, or even a flag. And that was the signal for the deck control officer, who was usually the batsman as well, but on the takeoff drill he was the deck landing control officer. He would, the first one to take off was already on the centre line, pointing up the middle, so he just wound his little flag round in a circle. And the pilot opened the throttle with the brakes on, holding the brakes on until he got full power on, and then the control officer dropped his flag just at the point when if the ship was pitching, just when she was beginning to lift her nose, so that the plane just shot forward along the deck. Well, I say shot forward, it lumbered along the deck. And hopefully by the time it got just past the island, it was airborne and away. And then as a pilot, your immediate task was to turn to starboard, brake to starboard, so that you would clear the your prop wash, the wake from your propeller, from the deck, so that the chap behind you was going to come up in clean air, as it were. And then it just went on like that. You were signalled out from your position in the dovetail onto the centre line, wind you up, and away you go, one by one by one. And again, you would get airborne probably less than 20 seconds between each aircraft. The problem arose if one of the aircraft had gone wrong or suddenly couldn't, and then of course there was all sorts of double shuffling had to be done so that the others could take off while one was stuck behind.
And do the aircraft that have already taken off, would they just circuit around there?
They would, depending on what exercise you were doing. I mean, if you were going off as individuals to do an anti-submarine patrol, well, you didn't wait for anybody else, you got on with it. But if you were going as a squadron, they would just circle the ship and you'd all join up. And that was another exercise. How quickly could you get into formation? Quite easy in daylight.
If there's a problem, though, if a problem developed as you were trying to take off, again, is there any kind of precautions that you can take to stop before reaching the end of...
Not really. if the engine misfired or something went wrong during your takeoff run, well, you could probably try and stop on your brakes, but I think it would be a bit hairy. No, I think once you were committed to the takeoff, you went.
You mentioned other ways?
There were other ways of getting off, and the obvious one was the accelerator, or the catapult, and our ship only had one. I mean, the big ships now, of course, have got two, and even the Americans have got, I think, four catapults or something. But we had one right up on the port bow. Which I had I think it was about 120 feet of track, this thing, and they loaded you on there on a little trolley thing, and you were sort of shackled onto this catapult with a wire strops that would pull you, and basically this was worked hydraulically under tremendous pressure. And you just sat on this thing, and they wound you up full power, and then the chap dropped his fling, and off you went. You know, usually you were slightly blacked out at the time because they had to get you up to flying speed in 120 feet, which was quite something. It was exciting, and Dixon not being the most clued up pilot, the first time I did it, it's you imagine you're sitting there right on at the bow of the ship. There's nobody in front of you, nothing at all except open sea. You're sitting there